You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, April 23rd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, I catch up following my week's vacation, week plus, really. Supreme Court rules that Michiganders can, by referendum, end affirmative action programs. Also, more and more data and arguments about the implications of wealth inequality on political inequality. Right-wing terror machine continues on unabated. Keystone decision delayed. More on Chris Christie and not really his official cousin across the river, Andrew Cuomo, and the heartwarming tale, the political struggles of potential political prisoner Dinesh D'Souza. And the New York Police Department gets an abject lesson in the use of social media. All that and more. We will take your phone calls, maybe even in the first half of the program today, as I try to get back up to speed. I'm shaking off the rust. Of course, my broadcasting skills have not diminished. It's part of the reason why I don't try and bring them to the highest of heights that I know they could reach, just so that I never have to show any rust. Wow. Sort of built in. Sort of like a built-in, it's almost like the Situationist in some way, in that I like to build in the critique. Baked into the cake. There you are. I will endeavor to bring back all of my tired metaphors and similes. First off, I want to say congratulations to Jonathan Cohn, who received a Sidney Hillman Award for 2014 on his piece on the nightmare of American daycare. In fact, we interviewed Jonathan Cohn almost a year to the day on that piece. You can go back, I think it was April 18th of 2013. Very pleased to be able to amplify that piece, and happy that it was recognized. And then I also want to offer, I mean, I don't want to, you know, my highest of congratulations, whatever the peak congratulations to the one and only, and I do mean one and only, Digby, of the Uber blog, Hubbubbalaloo, and I bring back my classic inability to pronounce hullabaloo, for winning a Hillman Award for opinion and analysis specifically on how it deals with income inequality in this country. It is well past the time, frankly, that Digby is recognized for the work that she has been doing at Hullabaloo for what I believe is now 11 years. I mean, over the break, Atrios celebrated his 12th blogging anniversary. And I think I've mentioned many times on this program how when I got the job at Air America, one of the highlights for me was to meet Atrios, because I wanted him on the program. He did one of our early training shows, and I invited him up to the launch party of Air America. And I found Digby, obviously, through Atrios. I think she was a commenter on his blog first and then started her own blog. And Digby is just literally, I mean, I don't say this about many people, but is literally a national treasure. And
at the very least, they're internet pioneers.
Well, internet pioneers, but I think even more importantly, in some ways, we're pioneers sort of in terms of political analysis. And
I think they legitimized very early on the whole political online sphere,
yes,
which is immensely important now.
Yes. And so long overdue that Digby gets recognition from sort of the more established, I guess, sort of media folks. I think she launched her blog at the beginning of 2003, maybe on January 1st. And
that precedes like even YouTube being a thing.
Oh,
like,
yes.
That's way before that.
But congratulations to Digby. I'm very proud that at this program, you know, we only have so much of a reach. And I think, you know, we speak to specific people. I guess everybody does, but the opportunity to amplify voices like Digby's and pieces like Jonathan Cohn wrote, which I imagine there was probably no other interview of Jonathan Cohn on that piece.
We can double check.
We can double check that.
I really, at the very least, he wasn't like making all of the rounds.
No. And, Digby, of course, does not get the national attention from the mainstream media, as it were, as she should. And I hope that changes in the wake of her being awarded this Hillman Award. I mean, frankly, she should be writing op-eds in the New York Times, as far as I'm concerned.
Every time I read Digby, my thought is always just, she's so smart. That really, I mean, that's the kind of simplest thing that I could say about it. She's just...
That is the simplest.
She's
smart.
Yes,
smart. But yes. And I think that goes without saying. I mean, to the point where she has coined narratives, I think the villagers, pearl clutching. She created her own internet meme just because of the respect that people had for her, where it was enough to post on one's blog what Digby said, and people would immediately click through to that link based on nothing other than someone recognized that Digby said something or wrote something. I guess Cohn was also on NPR, I'm being told, but I doubt they gave him 40 minutes.
They gave him an entire afternoon, of all things considered.
Well, whatever.
Yeah. So you stand corrected.
All right, I stand corrected. Look, we're not infallible here. The number is 646-257-3920. Like I say, we will endeavor to take phone calls during the course of the program. There's obviously a lot that I missed over the past week and a half. My understanding is that the ridiculousness that was going on in Nevada was covered extensively by Matt and Michael in my absence. And I'm glad to hear that. Let me dig into this affirmative action case in Michigan. This is something that I think perhaps in the near future we'll have a legal expert on. The case just broke over the past day, so didn't have the chance to sort of to book anyone. But the case, at least on its face. Because when you analyze anything that's happening with the Supreme Court, you have to see it in the context of a larger attempt by the right-wingers on this court to return this country to a time that was pre-civil rights, to return this country to a time that was pre-campaign finance, to the era of robber barons, and understand where this court is going when we talk about any of these issues. This case was not specifically about the constitutionality or even the merits of affirmative action or race-conscious admissions policies in higher education. This, according to Justice Kennedy in his pro-ban opinion. In 2006, Michiganders voted, I think it was like a 52 or to 48, or maybe it was even starker than that, to ban race-based preferences in 2006 in a referendum. And the question here was, will the Supreme Court uphold that ban as voted in a referendum? There was 7 states have banned it, in addition to Michigan. And the arguments against it were provided by Sonia Sotomayor. And they very much focused on the notion of the political process doctrine. I don't want to get too weedy here with this, but the political process doctrine is rooted in the 14th Amendment and basically says that when a court is to look at whether or not a state can make a determination as to whether or not it will ban, in this case, affirmative action policies for higher education, they must also look to the ability of minorities to actually have the opportunity to fully engage in the political process that led to a ban in this case. But undergirding much of those who landed, and I should say the case was decided 6-2, Kagan abstained. I'm not exactly sure. She may have been involved in the case in some fashion. And Breyer sided with the majority, but in a very limited fashion. But when you look at Thomas's and Scalia's, and to a certain extent, Roberts and Scalito's, Alito's ruling, you will see a slow march to finding that affirmative action policies may not be constitutional, that the idea of having any type of race-conscious legislation or policies is racial discrimination. In other words, saying that you can't remedy past racial discrimination by being race conscious today. It's an absurd principle. And just to give you a sense of what the implications are of that, I want to play some sound from Tim Wise at an Intelligence Squared debate. I think it was NPR. I'm not sure. One of those debates. And this is from 2007, shortly after this ban on affirmative action policies in Michigan was passed. And he speaks of we'll put a link to the YouTube. The entire thing is worth listening to, because he doesn't even go into existing discrimination as we see it today. He speaks only essentially of this notion of having no race consciousness when dealing with past racism. Let's play this clip.
You know, it always amazes me to hear critics of affirmative action speak about this subject as if racial preference were something that were invented in the 60s to benefit people of color. Because in fact, whether we wish to acknowledge it or not, and of course we don't, the entire history of this country is the history of affirmative action for white folks like myself. And unless we begin by discussing that affirmative action and the impact that it has had, we engage in a discussion that is both ethically and practically irresponsible. Contrary to what Joseph tells you, this debate is about the extent to which racism still exists, because it is indeed the existence of that racism which necessitated affirmative action in the beginning and continues to necessitate it today. Whether we wish to acknowledge it or not, enslavement, Indian genocide, segregation did not only oppress people of color, they elevated white folks and provided us with opportunities that we did not in fact earn. The Homestead Act allowed whites to claim over 270 million acres of land for virtually nothing down at a time when folks of color could not. Today, there are 40 million white folks descended directly from those who received that land giveaway, millions of them still living on the property. They owe their lives to affirmative action. Then there was the FHA home loan program, which for the first 30 years of its existence operated in a whites-only fashion, lending over $120 billion worth of government-backed housing equity to whites, thereby creating the white middle class. And in large measure, because of those preferences, the typical black college couple, college-degreed couple, starts out with less than one-fifth the net worth of the typical young white couple, because the latter of those has likely received the benefits of their family's prior head start, while the former are likely to have accumulated far less, having had less chance to do so. So against that backdrop, ending affirmative action would only further cement the systemic advantages for whites that have been in place for hundreds of years. It would be tantamount to favoring those three laps ahead in a five-lap race, even though those who were ahead gained their head start as the result of an unfair process.
So, I mean, this notion of a lack of race consciousness is simply, it just belies common sense. And now what you're going to see, and what some are arguing, and as well on the left, is that this affords the opportunity of a place like University of Michigan to look at other factors, to provide affirmative action on other factors aside from race. Now, we know this exists already for advantaged people, more often than not, white people, and more often than not, rich people. There is an affirmative action policy that has always been in existence for legacy applicants. If your father or mother went to a university, you get a little boost. Whatever the units they use in determining your worth in terms of being admitted to a college or a university, if you are a legacy, and particularly even more so if your parents have contributed to the endowment of the college, you get extra points. If you come from a good school, you get extra points. In some instances, if you come from certain regions that aren't a function of race but end up being from white regions, you get a boost. If you do well on standardized testing, which we know is also a function of your income, maybe you can afford to go to Kaplan and prep. You get a boost. There's all sorts of affirmative action that takes place in college admissions. Since the voters banned racial preferences in 06 in Michigan, the percentage of black and Hispanic first-year students at the University of Michigan has dropped from 12.15% to 9.54%. That's a 25% decline, even as it occurred as the total number of college-age blacks and Hispanics rose in the state. That's from Emily Bazelon. That's late. And Adam Serwer highlighted Sonia Sotomayor's dissent in this decision. Sonia Sotomayor, who has credited, at least in her biography, her autobiography, affirmative action as helping her get into college, into law school. She argues that by amending the state constitution to bar race-conscious admissions allows a white graduate of public Michigan University who wishes to pass his historical privilege on to his children to freely lobby the board of that university in favor of an expanded legacy admissions policy. However, a black Michigander who was denied the opportunity to attend that very university is now unable to lobby the board in favor of a policy that might give his children a chance that he never had and that they might never have. In doing so, Sotomayor wrote, the state has unconstitutionally barred racial minorities from fully participating in the political process. They do not have the platform on which to lobby from that was afforded a white person, because they got in at a time where there were discriminatory practices or other factors that prevented black people from having the same opportunity to go to that college. She writes, in my colleague's view, examining the racial impact of legislation only perpetuates racial discrimination. She's talking about Roberts' notion that the only way to end discrimination is to end discrimination based on race, one way or another. This refusal to accept the stark reality that race matters is regrettable. My colleagues are of the view that we should leave race out of the picture entirely and let the voters sort it out. It is a sentiment out of touch with reality, not one required by our Constitution, and one that has properly been rejected as not sufficient to resolve cases of this nature. Again, she is arguing the political process doctrine and saying that the court must, when it comes to race, the court must provide extra scrutiny on whether or not a referendum passed by voters does not in itself still disadvantage black people because of their historical ability, where both in dealing with not just that referendum, but them engaging in the political process after the result of that referendum. In other words, as a white person, your chances of being able to lobby based on legacy are far greater than a black person. She writes, race matters to a young man's view of society when he spends his teenage years watching others tense up as he passes, no matter the neighborhood where he grew up. Race matters to a young woman's sense of self when she states her hometown and then is pressed, no, where are you really from? Regardless of how many generations her family has been in the country. Race matters to a young person addressed by a stranger in a foreign language, which he does not understand because only English was spoken at home. Race matters because of the slights, the snickers, the silent judgments that reinforce the most crippling of thoughts, I do not belong here. Roberts responds, it's not out of touch with the reality to conclude that racial preference may themselves have the debilitating effect of reinforcing precisely that doubt. And if so, that the preference do more harm than good. This notion that somehow by banning affirmative action, we are actually protecting the self-esteem of black students, of Latino students, because now they can be sure that they are at this school based on their own merits, is ludicrous. You do not see folks whose parents went to the university and undoubtedly got a leg up in the admissions process walk around with their heads hanging low. Like, I don't belong here. You do not see white people who took the Stanley Kaplan course and were able to get higher, or rich people who were able to take the Stanley Kaplan course and they added 30 points to their verbal and their math scores, walking around going like, I don't really belong here. You do not see people who come from a wealthy high school in an all-white district who had opportunities to do all sorts of extracurriculars that are not available at other schools go, you know, I really don't belong here because my opportunity to do candy striping instead of working, or my opportunity to, you know, sort of do work on the high school radio show got me into this school. You just don't see it. People can disagree in good faith on the issue, but it similarly does more harm than good to question the openness and candor of those on either side of the debate. In other words, you hurt my fifis by saying I don't understand. I'm helping black people. Meanwhile, Sonia Sotomayor, who has said and attributed at least part of her success to affirmative action, seems to be doing okay for herself. Her self-esteem, as she sits on the Supreme Court, does not seem to be lacking. She seems to feel that she belongs there. So it may be the case that in this narrow context, in the ability of universities to provide some type of racial diversity by other means, in other words, crediting geographic locations, crediting socioeconomic status, crediting other things that tend to correlate with being a racial minority, may make up for some of this diversity inequality. It clearly is not working in Michigan. And, you know, there are some arguments. I think Richard Collenberg of the Century Foundation has argued that there's far greater disparity or lack of diversity when you look at socioeconomic factors. In other words, if you look at representation of African Americans, for instance, similarly situated economic background, there's less of a disparity between them and white kids of that same background than there is just in general of economic disparity. The larger point in terms of this ruling, the aspects of this ruling that are so disturbing, is that this is one more step that the Supreme Court is taking to attempting to impose this completely nonsensical and frankly, I think, with all due respect to John Roberts and his fifis, disingenuous. Because you really, I mean, it is no different in my mind, in terms of being out of touch, than Mitt Romney looking out at an audience and saying, the problem with you folks is you don't have the gumption. Go and borrow 25 grand from your parents. Start a business. Just being completely out of touch with the realities that either most people face or minorities face, and the lack of social capital that exists there that was a function of historic discrimination. And this is to say nothing of the existing discrimination. We know of the studies which show that, you know, you got a better chance of getting a job if you put a white-sounding name on your application than an African-American-sounding name. We know of all the other benefits that accrue to you just because you have a legacy of people who have had more opportunities and have built those opportunities and have accrued those opportunities, at least in some part because of the racial discrimination that was taking place in our society. So, I know, it's disturbing, to say the least. And it is, on some level, this notion of, like, you know, it really, really undercuts this generation of people who would go into school and somehow feel they were there because of affirmative action. It doesn't give them the dignity. I mean, it is. It's very much like the Paul Ryan made-up lunch story. And one also has to wonder, you know, I don't know if Justice Thomas, you know, has said, I think, in the past, I mean, I don't know that it has haunted me that I don't belong
here. He personally has made some stunning comments about, I think, the story I read, and I'd want to double check it, but I do recall reading a story that he took out, he made a small rip in his Yale law degree to symbolize the percentage that affirmative action played in his admission. So he certainly, in his own personal psychological makeup and whatever the hell is going on with that guy, does have a grievance about it.
Now that may be the case, but let's look at the alternate history where he doesn't get into Yale Law School, where he doesn't get into his undergrad school. What are the chances at that point of success for his children? They necessarily diminish. And his grandchildren, they necessarily diminish. Even if one could show, and I think in this case, this specific case in Michigan, they showed that there were 85, I think, minority students who got in, who did not have the grades that the plaintiff, I think, in this case, got. There were apparently hundreds more who were not minorities, who were white, who also did not have the grades of the plaintiffs in this case, but they had other factors, like they were legacy students. But, you know, one wonders, where Thomas's grandkids would be if he didn't have this opportunity. I mean, I knew students at my undergrad who, you know, would say that they were helped. They were helped. They were the first kid in their families to go to college, in their entire family. And I don't know if these guys felt that they didn't belong there. But I do know that their kids are going to college. And that, I mean, this is the way that you make up. And it's not just a question of fairness. It is the way that you allow people who have been running a race starting 50 yards behind the starting line to improve society in general. I mean, I think it's even almost wrong to even use that metaphor in that context, because it's not just about those individuals in that race. And, you know, this is over the past couple of weeks, there's been a book that's gotten a lot of attention from a French economist, Thomas Piketty, right? Is that it? Piketty. And I attempted to start it. I did start it over my vacation, and of course I didn't get very far, but because Nikki was not on vacation, so I was basically doing a lot of child rearing and whatnot.
Say, Dad's reading Piketty.
Right.
So not available right now.
That's right. I did the one book that I have gotten through, honestly, cover to cover, in the past month, was the novelization of Frozen.
I haven't seen the movie, but I hear it's really good.
Well, the book is great. The book is better. based completely on the movie. But Myla wanted me to read that to make sure that it wasn't too sad for her to watch the movie.
Is it too sad? I need to know as well.
No, you'll be fine.
Okay.
And we did end up watching the movie, but the broad sweep of the book, the top line, as I understand it, is that we are reverting to form when it comes to sort of the oligarchy. That we had a period in world history where accrued wealth passed from generation to generation was disrupted by world wars, and that with the falling of the top marginal tax rates, it is regaining steam. And the book calls for a return, I think, to these higher top marginal rates. Kathleen Greer, I think she blogs at the Washington Monthly. She wrote a piece on Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century, and also on a paper that Piketty and some of his collaborators did for the American Economic Journal, Economic Policy. And they find a strong relationship between tax cuts for rich people and the soaring economic inequality we've seen in the U.S. and many other countries since the 1970s. There's a clear correlation between the drop in marginal tax rates and the surge in top income shares since 1960, they reported in this paper. The research also shows that tax cuts for the top 1% had no impact on economic growth. So this story that we are told that, well, basically trickle down is in fact what we've been saying it is. That trickling down is a golden shower. And it's not gold that it's showering upon us. I don't think that's a quote from the paper. That was my assessment of what they're saying. We find no evidence of a correlation between growth in real GDP per capita and the drop in the top marginal tax rate in the period from 1960 to the present. Some of their models show that it's even detrimental to growth, which also makes sense because you have sidelined money. As we've heard on this program many times before, a rich man only buys one loaf of bread at a time. You can only have so many cars. The authors estimate that the socially optimal top marginal tax rate is 83%. And the reason for this tax rate is not to generate revenue for society. It is specifically to be a ballast against inequality. The purpose is not so much to raise revenue, but to discourage economically and socially destructive activity. In other words, the accumulation of such wealth that it begins to destroy the fabric of our democratic society, that it begins to destroy the fabric of our politics. And it's well-timed. There was, and I think I mentioned this when I was talking to Cliff in Vegas a week and a half ago, there was another report put out by Martin Gillens. We have Gillens on this program? I think we did. About his earlier work.
Best of last
week. Oh, we played on the best of, yes. He had done a lot of work on the implications of political wealth inequality as it implicated political inequality. And his most recent study takes it even further. quote an interview he did with Talking Points Memo. Contrary to what decades of political science research might lead you to believe, ordinary citizens have virtually no influence over what their government does in the United States. And economic elites and interest groups, especially those representing business, have a substantial degree of influence. Discussing the terms economic elite domination and biased pluralism means that is that rather than the average citizens of moderate means having an important role in determining policy, ability to shape outcomes is restricted to the people at the top of the income distribution and to organized groups that represent primarily, though not exclusively, business. We have moved from our plutonomy to our plutocracy. And we see the implications of this all around us, whether it is austerity policies, whether it is the destruction of the middle class. Apparently, in 2004, or I should say 2010, was the first year since 1980 that the median percentile, economic percentile of the United States now trails another country, be Canada, in after-tax income, relatively speaking. So, I mean, if you look at this graph I'm looking at, the 95th, the 90th, the 80th, the 70th, the 60th percentile of highest income dominated by the United States. And it has dominated since 1980. But you can see slowly, starting in 1980, that those with after-tax income, the United States starts to move down the list in terms of where those percentiles stand relative to other Western countries. In other words, our middle class is contracting. It's not nothing that you don't know, but it's the reality. We're going to take a break, head into the funner half, wherein I may talk a little bit more about this. But I'll do it in a fun way. You'll never guess how much a Sunday.
That was a new evolution. You're not even teasing the unfun
stuff. I'm gonna tease some fun stuff.
I will continue to expound upon the unfun stories in the fun half of the program.
Yes, but however, shortly. I will also tell the funny story of Dinesh D'Souza, who got hoisted by his own petard. I think I don't know if I've ever used that term on this program, but I think that's
actually exactly what happens.
Yes.
There's no stretch there.
Almost, not only, I think it's also a literal explanation of what happened.
What a sociopath.
Yes. The number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Folks, I understand the dynamic when I am not live every day pleading for you to become a member of the Majority Report. You begin to get lulled into a sense of complacency. However, those who must end their membership for financial reasons, they have no such complacency. So we lost a little ground over the past week and a half. If you can afford to become a member of the Majority Report, please do support this program. We will continue to bring you stories from future Hillman Prize winners, to the best of our ability.
And don't forget to let...
Post or former Hillman Prize winners? What?
And don't forget to let Sam know the reason you're becoming a member is because of those three straight Matt and Mike shows that happened last week.
There you go. If that's what it takes, then by all means. You can also support this program by buying your crap from Amazon. If you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our link. We get a kickback. Jeff Bezos can suck an egg. As far as I'm concerned,
are you making a Bezos joke there, buddy?
Why is he?
Because I was trying to give you more credit. You were just saying suck an egg, but he does have a sort of egg shaped oval.
No, I wasn't trying to make a joke. I was simply saying, like,
just giving you more credit than you deserve. All right,
send me some of Jeff Bezos' money. That's what I'm saying. Simply go to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, always buy your crap through Amazon. You will notice no difference. Does not affect your experience or your cost one iota. We get a little kickback. Every little bit helps. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Coupon code MAJORITY. Fair trade. Employee-owned company. Great coffee. Win, 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 win. And also, of course, give us a review on iTunes. Pick up the app at MajorityApp.com. The number 646-257-3920. Call in now. I will put you on the air. If you're a libertarian, want to call in about what this is rising socialistic fervor in this country, please, by all means. Oh, also, we got to get in touch with that professor. I totally forgot about that. I think it's next week.
It's next week?
Maybe. I'm not sure. I got to double check. It just occurred to me. You write a note about that? Send me an email. Also, you can IM me at Majority FM. We'll be back in just a moment.